It's 1240. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. Over the past couple of decades, communities across the country have been demolishing their public housing developments. In Chicago, the notorious Cabrini Green and Robert Taylor homes were torn down and residents were encouraged to instead move into the private market. The city of Danville, Illinois, hopes to do something similar, primarily by tearing down its 70-year-old housing complex, Fair Oaks. But the city is receiving pushback by its housing authority and public housing residents. In the third and final installment of his series, Landon Kassman reports on the debate.
Danville Community Development Manager John Dreer says that an undeniable trend in Fair Oaks isn't fair to its residents.
Fair Oaks has 320-some units, I think it is. And although no one intended it this way, it has ended up being 80% African-American, female, under the age of 25, with children, no husband. It's a singular demographic. And that's not good for them or for anybody else. It's also gotten a reputation where, I know there's some very nice people that do live there, and I don't mean to impugn them, but nice people don't want to live there.
City and housing authority officials disagree on how public housing should be redeveloped. The city previously proposed closing Fair Oaks while also decreasing the amount of available Section 8 vouchers, which are used to supplement a person's fair market rent. Danville Housing Authority Executive Director Greg Hillary just doesn't see how that is possible.
It doesn't make sense to me that we can just arbitrarily kick 300 families to the street, not house them, because that's illegal. We're going to have to house them. But in order to do that, there's going to have to be changes either on the Section 8 side for additional funding to issue those vouchers, or we're going to have someplace else to house them. And I think that's the philosophical difference that we seem to have that we need to work out.
Both the city and the housing authority agree that the high-density, one-demographic public housing complex is not ideal. Instead, they hope to move on to what they call a mixed-income model of public housing. A study commissioned by the Danville Housing Authority concluded 466 additional units of public housing are needed to meet current demand. But Dreer says that figure is unacceptable. Expanding public housing, he says, is not the direction to take. Instead, moving people out of public housing should be the city's main goal.
We just happen to think that the expansion of more and more and more free housing doesn't really help anyone. I know that's, but that sounds awfully rough when you're the person out there who needs it, but we'd rather lift that person to productivity than just park them in an apartment and walk away and leave them for 50 years. And that's kind of what I think the Housing Authority has been doing.
Corey Dorsey has been living in Fair Oaks now for over a year. He understands why people would end up staying for an extended period of time.
People fell into the comfort of $17 a month for rent, or a LIHEAP program, or, you know, programs to help pay your bills. And, you know, and it takes responsibility from people of getting up and getting out and getting their own. You know, it's technically almost babyfying them. They're almost robbing us of our will to live. You know what I'm saying? Robbing us of our survival skills almost by babyfying us.
Danville Mayor Scott Eisenhower says that the Housing Authority's reasons for not pursuing funding for redevelopment are just excuses.
What's been so frustrating to me, however, is the long delay after delay, excuse after excuse, as to why we can't move forward in a direction of providing a far more successful housing environment than what we provide today. There is no question in my mind, and while I recognize it's going to take some time and money, we already should be moving in the direction of having hired an architect, laid out what a mixed income living arrangement should look like. We should be out knocking on doors, looking at funding, finding out what state and federal programs exist. We're not doing any of those things. And again, that's a charge that the Housing Authority has been given by this administration that unfortunately they just haven't picked up the ball and ran with.
Hillary says that this discussion should have started a long time ago.
I think one of the important things that needs to happen is much more communication. We need to work on this problem together. It hasn't been that way. It's been tear it down and then deal with it later. That's not how we need to work on this.
The city and the Housing Authority have been meeting on a monthly basis to discuss plans for redevelopment. but it still may be years before Fair Oaks is shut down. I'm Landon Kassman for Illinois Public Media.
And for more on this story, including an interactive map, visit will.illinois.edu and cucitizenaccess.org. The city of New Orleans is rallying around its famous newspaper, the Times-Picayune, as it goes through layoffs and limited publication. The public outcry is escalating, with the upper echelon of the city's political, business, and cultural leaders pleading with the paper's parent company to reconsider some of its recent moves. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
What happens when a media company wants to take away your daily newspaper? In New Orleans, you take to the streets. Bandleader Kermit Ruffins is among the high-profile musicians who headlined a recent rally to preserve daily publication. It's part of a campaign launched by New Orleans' most prominent citizens and powerful leaders who have rallied behind the Times-Picayune, a 175-year-old cultural institution in a city that gives high credence to tradition.
It's the morning ritual.
Constable Lambert Boissier is a former city councilman and state senator.
You know, you get the paper, get your cup of coffee, have a little breakfast or whatever, and you're paging through, reading articles you want to read. Then you had the conversations at lunch about what you read in the paper. You know, so that's going to be gone. I can't imagine myself and a lot of my friends sitting in front of a computer every morning to go through the different sections of the paper to read the articles. I don't see that happening.
More than a third of New Orleans residents don't have internet access, raising questions about how poorer and older citizens will keep up with news or even the local obituaries. Rituals aside, Boissier says, the timing is terrible.
We finally cleaned up our act since Katrina. We got business coming back, our athletics things with the Hornets and the Saints. We got a Super Bowl, we had Final Four, everything. We're getting to be a big city again. And then to lose a daily paper, I think it's a bad signal for, you know, affecting the growth of the city.
And that's what concerns civic leaders who have banded together to put pressure on the Newhouse company to rethink their plan. New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu says the city's reputation is at stake.
You know, if you go from 7 days to 3 days, you look like a minor league city.
I fully grasp the grief over what people think will no longer be there.
Times-Picayune editor and native New Orleanian Jim Amos. He says the organization will continue to do justice by the community.
And I know these are just words at this point. Our intention is to preserve the news report, the investigative journalism, our chasing after corruption in Louisiana.
Amos says economic upheaval in the news industry is something that every regional newspaper must confront.
The one way we have chosen not to come to terms with it is by simply atrophying, by watching our print ad revenue, which is still strong, erode year by year as it will and as it has, and by having to chop off limb after limb of our news gathering strength without having any strategy going forward.
But if this week's layoffs are any indication, 200 in New Orleans and 400 in Alabama, more than a few limbs have been amputated.
My name is John McCusker, and I've been a staff photographer at the Times-Picayune since 1986.
McCusker lost his job in the restructuring. I spoke with him outside a local bar where laid-off workers met to commiserate.
The main thing is I'm sad for this city. You take away the Times-Picayune, and there are a bunch of police officers that were on the Danziger Bridge that would still be on the streets today. You take away the Times-Picayune, and Aaron Broussard is still president of Jefferson Parish. The watchdog role of this newspaper cannot be underestimated.
He's talking about how reporters exposed corrupt politicians and even a police plot to cover up civilian killings after Katrina. The paper's storm coverage earned a Pulitzer Prize. Restaurateur Ralph Brennan is part of a group of Times-Picayune advertisers considering whether to pull their spending in protest. He's disheartened by the list of seasoned journalists who are leaving, including the paper's restaurant critic.
They have an outstanding staff. Many of them have been there a long time. Brett Anderson's one of them. And, you know, Brett has a national reputation. He's very well respected in the food journalism community, and to lose him is a great loss. And this is a food city.
One Picayune punch.
Brennan's restaurants are serving special drinks like this, with a portion of proceeds going to help those who lost their jobs. He and other business leaders are now looking for alternatives.
I keep hoping that somebody, an entrepreneur out there, will find a way to get us some daily news and maybe build a newspaper.
Three-day publication is set to take effect in the fall. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, New Orleans.
Come along on our custom-designed trip to England and Wales this September. Experience the real Downton Abbey in a private tour just for friends of WILL. See lovely Cotswold villages, the Yorkshire countryside, and meet Alan J. W. Bell, producer of Last of the Summer Wine. Tour Greenway, Agatha Christie's home, the English spa town of Bath, and visit the Jane Austen Center before wrapping up the trip in London. Our tour is almost full, so call 217-333-7300 for more information.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, the 14th of June, 2012. Flag Day in the United States, the day on which, in 1777, the government officially adopted the Stars and Stripes as our national flag. It's the birthday of Diablo Cody, born Brooke Busey in Lamont, Illinois, 1978. She started a popular blog about life as a stripper, and a talent agent saw it, helped her publish her memoir, Candy Girl, A Year in the Life of an Unlikely Stripper. Then he suggested that she write a screenplay, and in just a couple of months, sitting with her laptop in the Starbucks in a Target store in Minneapolis, she wrote the screenplay for Juno, which, in 2007, became a big hit. It was the highest-grossing movie for Fox Searchlight Pictures. And it's the birthday of a man whose image became a counterculture icon, Che Guevara, born Ernesto Guevara de la Serna in Rosario, Argentina, 1928, parents of Irish and Spanish descent. An affluent socialist family, they sent him off to medical school, and when he was 23, he took a year off and set out on a motorcycle ride for 9 months, 8,000 miles. Wrote a book about it. It was a New York Times bestseller, The Motorcycle Diaries. Che Guevara finished medical school, went to Guatemala, then to Mexico, where he became friends with Raul Castro, who introduced him to his older brother Fidel, who was in exile in Mexico after leading a failed uprising in Cuba. Che Guevara and Fidel had a series of meetings in 1955, gathered other Cuban exiles into their ranks. Che Guevara was in charge of training soldiers for combat. The first guerrilla fighters set out in an old yacht called the Grandma. And in late December 1958, Che Guevara led a crucial victory in the town of Santa Clara against the corrupt Batista regime, which fell on January 1, 1959, and Fidel Castro marched victoriously.